It's Nostalzipod, and we have a ton to talk about today. I'm going to get right into the first question because it is sort of a current event, if you will, a rather sad one. But this comes from Lance Tomimoto, so let's get into it. Has the death of people you never met personally or only interacted with online affected you? What's the experience like? I was ambivalent about Ed Piskor prior to his recent allegations and was definitely disappointed when they were made public, but I also watched a lot of cartoonist kayfabe videos because of my love of comics, and I know that you are also a fan. It's been quite a roller coaster on the Facebook group last week and this morning, and now I find myself a little sad and disoriented with his passing. I'm not sure, maybe it's because I saw his face a lot or heard his voice for long periods of time, through the videos, or because of the manner of his death, but it's not like I ever interacted with him or knew him personally. I bought all the collected X-Men Grand Design, and I guess I find myself surprised that it's having an emotional impact on me. Sorry for the long post, it's a weird feeling. I hope all the Squires out there are mentally healthy and thriving. Pizza and universe bless. I think Lance is sort of pinpointing a lot of things I'm thinking and feeling right now. So for those who don't know, I'll keep this brief, but Ed Piskor is a comic artist, and he was co-host of a very popular cartoonist kayfabe YouTube, a show that I watched and am a patron of on Patreon. And I didn't know about any of this stuff until a couple days ago, but apparently Ed was accused of some sex pest or grooming behavior or worse, and he ended his life, apparently. So it's a big, heavy fucking thing, and I think the ultimate thing I come down on is I do not possess moral clarity on any of this, okay? I can't make a judgment. I can't make a ruling. I don't know how I feel about this. There is a lot of gray areas involved in all of this. And I think it's important that everybody sort of acknowledge that for themselves. We do not have to have a moralistic stance on every event that happens. We do not have to understand with certitude these big, complex questions and things that happen. The entire ordeal just seems very sad and very pathetic and very cruel. But I don't know what else to say. I can't exonerate anybody. I cannot condemn anybody. I think the other absolute truth that is apparent in this sad situation is that the internet can turn on all of us, right? And there are obviously very bad repercussions when that happens. Part of why it feels so bad for me is that I imagine any one of us could have any past behavior whatsoever scrutinized. That's not to say that these are not past behaviors worth scrutiny or worth, sort of blowing up the spot of somebody. That remains to be seen. But this could happen to any of us. We have digital footprints, and human beings do not always behave in the best manner, especially, kind of early internet. I've said and done shit on the internet in the early eras, like pre-2010, that was just sort of purposefully being an edgelord and inciting people's humors and just being a real piece of shit. I think everybody who grew up with the internet kind of goes through a trollish sort of phase. And that's not to say, the events that occurred here is somebody being trollish or disingenuous, but it is to say that, there are no angels on the internet. And, I can easily imagine anybody I know being the target of a sort of mob mentality. And none of that is to say that, these women that have come forward do not deserve to tell their story or be heard or be taken seriously or at face value. But it is to say that, this technology, which we do not fully comprehend can sort of make and break people. I think also another thing I was thinking of is that if you are an insecure person, and I don't know that Ed was, you know, just saying in general, if you have insecurities and you get a little bit of notoriety, if you get a little brush with fame, if your work starts to sort of take hold with people, that notoriety being taken away can be very, very damaging. And if you do not have a support system, if you don't have a wide life outside of your work, if you don't have other hobbies, other pursuits, other ways to make money that you can sort of turn to when the tides turn against you on the internet, you know, you can really be left with nothing or feel like you're left with nothing. You know, with my pursuit of the Knights of the Slice toy line over the past 10 years, there have been highs and lows. We're not exactly at the lowest point of this past 10 years of Knights of the Slice, but we're not exactly at the highest point either. And if I didn't have a life outside of Knights of the Slice, when the sales are down or the trend is moving away from collectibles, I could see a younger version of myself really being suicidal or being depressed over that. Now, Knights of the Slice is one facet of what I consider to be a life that makes me very happy. So, when things aren't going great in the toy realm, I go hang out with my buddies, I go play music, I go on a hike, I dive into a video game like Dragon's Dogma 2. There's any number of sort of outlets for me, and a sort of support system, and, you know, people I love and care for, a meaningful long-term relationship, my relationship with my pets, even though they irk the shit out of me most of the time. I have all these things that kind of help bear the brunt if one aspect of my life is not clicking into place. A lot of comic artists that I know and that I'm friends with are singularly focused, right? A lot of them sacrifice a lot in terms of relationship and family to chase this dream. A lot of them work largely in solitary confinement, keeping to themselves, you know, drawing line by line, panel by panel. And comics is not what it was 20 years ago. It's not what it was 50 years ago. It is exceedingly, soul-crushingly hard to get any recognition, any sales, anything of that nature. And if you are singularly focused on this really dramatically difficult to break into world, that kind of sets you up for, you know, not being in a great headspace. And then to experience a rush of success and then have that success taken away or threatened, you know, I can imagine that probably can destroy somebody's ego pretty quickly. So yeah, you know, I'm feeling exactly how Lance is. It's a very sad, very confusing sort of situation. Again, one does not want to discount people coming forward and having complaints about somebody's behavior. And I think at the end of the day, like I said, there's no moral clarity here. I don't fucking know what to think. And I don't know that we'll ever sort of have a full picture of everything. So it's, you know, it's one of these situations where you just have to sit with the undefined and with not knowing. And I think as I get older, that's the most important lesson I've learned in my 40s, is that a lot of life is sitting with indefinite things and being uncomfortable with that. And it is excruciating. It's, you know, why many people turn to vice to sort of deal with it. That is part of the human condition. This idea of not knowing what's right, having events happen that kind of, you know, are disturbing on multiple levels, and not having closure, not having anything you can do to sort of fix the situation. This is the majority of adult life, is kind of being able to tolerate this intolerable feeling. And, you know, it's kind of an excruciating feeling. I just don't know. I don't know. I'm confused. I'm upset. And it'll be that way until it sort of wears off a little bit. And, you know, I have sort of, I'm not offering much here, I know, other than to say, I get what you mean. And I think that, you know, generally, probably people are feeling the same way if they're familiar at all with the story and what's happening here. There are, of course, a couple people I've seen celebrating and saying, you know, this is a, they're dunking on this. And, you know, I've certainly felt that way about people I perceive to be evil that have died. But for me, it's just, this feels like way too murky of a situation to kind of be able to, you know, stand on one side or the other and be like, yes, this was a righteous dispensing of justice. I don't see it that way. But, you know, I hear you. I read you loud and clear. Now, I'm going to do a hard pivot here. I'm going to attempt to try to pull us out of the ditch and get us into a little bit of levity and a little bit of a more positive direction. As you've probably seen, the first performer at Toy Pizza Expo 2024 has been announced, and that is WFYM. This is a podcast, and this is a Twitch stream that I love quite a bit, and I'm very excited to kind of introduce these guys to my audience in a bigger way. There's been some intersections previously, but I wanted to talk a little bit about why I'm doing this. Now, many people will know the WFYM crew for running the Chapo Trap House Twitch stream, and now I know a lot of people don't watch Twitch, but I watch a lot of Twitch, I watch a lot of YouTube, and these two platforms are far superior to the television experience as far as I'm concerned. And I think that the younger you are, the more you understand, appreciate, and consume something like YouTube. And then, you know, by another order of magnitude, the younger you are, the more you appreciate, connect with, consume Twitch in a big, meaningful way. So there is a bit of a generational gap here, and I can't fault anybody who doesn't know who these guys are, what Twitch is, whatever the case may be. Why is this important? Why the intersect here? Why sort of, you know, why do I want these guys to do their first live show ever at Toy Pizza Con? What does that have to do with toys? What does that have to do with Knights of Slice or anything, really? Simply put, I think these guys are the funniest guys out there. I listen to every podcast they do, I watch their Twitch stream, and I think that they have a formula that is really hilarious and would work really well for a live setting. The sort of elevator pitch for what they're going to do live is the Howard Stern Show meets America's Funniest Home Videos. They trawl the depths of YouTube and TikTok and things like that, and they find videos and wannabe influencers and share these videos and critique them almost in like a Mystery Science Theater 3000 sort of way. It's hilarious that the menagerie of freaks that they have found is staggering, and it's a very deep lore. It's a very funny sort of experience to kind of watch these videos and discover these different personalities and hear the individual riffs of these guys. And I think ultimately what it comes down to is I'm asking you guys and gals and non-binaries to trust me. I'm going to put on a show. I'm going to present you with something that you're not going to fully understand when you walk in the room. And you're not going to understand why you're paying to see this. But when you come out on the other side of this performance, you're going to be entertained. You're going to have a new memory. You're going to learn things you never thought you would ever learn about. And more importantly, we're going to experience it together as a group. This is not something that we're going to sort of purchase in a pre-order and get in the mail and in a very solitary pursuit and then, you know, write a blasting critique about on Discord. this is a group activity. We're going to see this live performance together. It's going to be hilarious. And you may not understand it right now at this moment, but I think if you come along on this journey, it is going to reward you afterwards. This also sort of, you know, pretty starkly shows the reason why this is no longer Toy Pizza Convention. This is Toy Pizza Expo. With the idea being, I don't just want people coming together to buy stuff and leave and forget about the day. I want people to get exposed to new ideas, to new, God, I hate to say it, but content creators, to see live performances, to hear live music, to eat food maybe you've never come in contact with before, and to just generally have an all-senses experience. And now, it would have been very easy to just, I don't know, have a Comic-Con-style panel about a single boring comic creator up on a microphone answering questions and, you know, I don't want that. I want to entertain people. I want performers. I want people with personality. I want people with jokes. I want to really cultivate an experience that's unlike any other sort of show you people have gone to. And part of that means there's going to be unknown things. There's going to be new things. There's going to be stimulus that you may not be a fan of yet. You may not even like. But I promise you, when you leave the yard in Beacon on Sunday, June 16th, you're going to be transformed, and hopefully in a good, positive way. Now, many years ago when I first moved to New York City, this was probably about 20 years ago, we would often go to the midnight showing at Upright Citizens Brigade. And this was underneath a Gristiti supermarket in a basement. But the UCB was this incredible hub of performers. It was not uncommon to go there and see Amy Poehler, Rob Corddry, Nick Kroll, Alec Baldwin. Like, if you were in New York and you had any comedic bones, you were passing through there. And I saw incredible, wild, crazy performances that I wouldn't even bear repeating because it wouldn't make any sense outside of that context. But one of the best shows was Video Nasty. And this was John Flynn and Jesse Falcon. And they would show VHS tapes of the most obscure, grotesque sort of things you could imagine. Now, this sounds like such an antiquated thing because YouTube and the internet have made that show completely irrelevant. Everybody knows Ricky O at this point. But for that time, it was groundbreaking. It was incredible. You were just seeing the full spectrum of the human experience through crazy bootlegged VHS tapes that had been banned in the UK and, you know, whatever else. And you know, it's sort of those you just had to be there kind of experiences, but there is something really magical about getting together as a group in a darkened room to see the sort of forbidden, you know, cinematic feats. And I see what WFYM are doing as being a sort of modern-day extension of that Video Nasty show. They have really sort of, WFYM have really done a great job of studying in a scientific manner this idea of the would-be internet celebrity. And they've pared it down to sort of the people, it's two qualities, really. The people that are least likely to ever gain any work through their YouTube presence or Twitter presence or whatever the case may be. These are the people least likely to ever be paid influencers. And these are also people that have the highest ego and self-assurance that path is mere inches away from where they are stepping right now, if they don't already delusionally consider themselves to be a celebrity. I know this all sounds like vagary and very abstract sort of things, but it will start to make sense as you see and appreciate the show. I look at what they're doing as a sort of sociological almost archivist activity. We're at this really hilarious and sad and absurd moment in time where likely the people that were going to make a living off of an internet presence have already sort of peaked and crested. But you are left with all of these wannabes that are sort of following that path, really thinking they're going to be the next Ninja or the next Hassan Piker or the next fill in the blank for whatever influencer you happen to know, because obviously a lot of this is inside baseball. So while it is sort of, it helps to be like a terminally online person to fully understand the scope of these platforms and the various personalities and a lot of the arguments they're making and discussions they're having, I think that even without knowing that, without having a Twitch, you know, without ever having watched Twitch or not even really consuming much YouTube, I think that there's a lot to be appreciated, and it's still a very sort of approachable kind of thing to experience. I don't think it's that alienating if you don't know all the terms and all the sort of, you know, like Shane Dawson. I don't even really know who that is, but I know that was a big YouTube personality that popped off a while back. He gets mentioned a lot because a lot of these sort of would-be influencers all sort of see that path and they want it for themselves. But in any case, I think you're going to really enjoy it. I think if you're hanging out in the courtyard around noon on that day when the show gets going, you're going to hear a lot of laughter from inside and probably people stomping their feet and crying out loud at the hilarity that's going on in the performance area. And you're going to feel like you missed out on something. And you know what? You will have. So if any of this sounds remotely interesting, or if you just want to roll the dice and trust that I'm going to put something on that's at least, at the very least, mildly interesting, go to the pre-order link and buy a ticket to see the WFYM show. I don't make anything off of the ticket sales here. The entirety of the money generated for the WFYM show, the majority goes to the performers themselves, minus what the venue needs to pay their staff to be there, run the lights, etc., etc. We're doing this completely above board. We're trying to put money in the performers' hands, and I don't get a piece of any of it, and I'm happy to sort of let it go to the people that are going to be on stage and performing. So check it out. If you want to do a little background research right now, you can look up WFYM on, you know, wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also check out the Twitch stream. I recommend the Sunday night streams where they go over all of these freak videos, if you will. That's twitch.tv/ChapoTrapHouse. And just to clear up any confusion that a lot of people have about Chapo Trap House and WFYM, Chapo Trap House is probably one of the biggest Patreons in existence. I think those people make like something absurd, a couple $1 million a year in subscriptions. Chapo Trap House is a political podcast. The Twitch stream is run by the WFYM guys. These are their friends. These are their buddies. They essentially outsourced to a different team of their friends and family the running of the Twitch channel. And it has gained quite a notoriety of itself. And out of that Twitch stream, the WFYM podcast launched. And so there is, they're part of the Chapo family, if you will. And, one final note. There may be some sort of special guest that they bring up on stage with them. So the less I say, the better. But again, you don't want to miss any of this. You got to trust me on this. You will be very happy you went and saw this show. Next question from Jerry Bow. Have you used or what are your thoughts on speed paints from the Army Painter Company? So I have used the Army Painter stuff. They are essentially a cheaper version of the Games Workshop paints, if you will, which can be very, very expensive, but generally are really good quality. I have a lot of the Army Painter's stuff. I find that their spray paint does not work for me. I don't like the granular size of the spray paint. I don't think it's good for my purposes. I think it's a bit too gloppy for miniatures. Again, I could have had a bad can or a bad batch, and maybe I'm not getting the full experience out of it, but I generally stick to Tamiya paints or Games Workshop spray paints if that's the application I'm doing. I think also, you know, I'm very stuck in my ways in using airbrush paints, but brushing them on. So I don't know that I have any of the airbrush paints from the Army Painter. I'm looking now. Okay, so they do have some airbrush paints. I've not tried those. Maybe they would work for my purposes. I've only sort of used their sort of standard undiluted acrylic paints, if you will. As far as the process of speed painting goes, I'm a big fan of it because I'm super impatient. So for those who don't know, speed painting is just like, how can I quickly get an army of soldiers up and running with the bare minimum of paints and doing the, you know, as little work as possible. I'm going to be a big fan of that in any discipline. So I really, you know, when I was experimenting with wargaming, I was certainly, you know, going down that path for sure. So I don't like to spend a lot of time painting or things like that. So, you know, that's kind of my philosophy as well. Next up from Brett Barnickel, this is a popular topic. I know I've talked at great lengths about it, but it'll be good to hear for newer people. What's your best advice for downsizing collections and curating better habits for collecting slash enjoying toys? Everybody is going through this right now, right? I have a sort of work Facebook account. I don't connect with any friends or anything like that through it, but I belong to a bunch of different toy groups and things like that. And almost across the board, everybody is liquidating their collections of any type of line imaginable. Acid Rain, G.I. Joe, Joy Toy, Warhammer, Knights of the Slice. Everybody is going through this sort of cultural process of reassessing what they're doing and what they want to collect and how they're spending their money and what the space in their house is taking up. I'm certainly going through it as well. It's a perfectly natural part of the hobby, and this urge will sort of ebb and flow. But I think because, like, you know, the vibes are really fucked up right now on a global scale, a lot of people are sort of having existential dread and reassessing what they're doing, what they're spending their money on, how their house is laid out, you know? It can be a kind of horrifying thing to look in the mirror that way. So basically, I want to keep this short because we have a lot of other questions to go through. But my process is get everything into one room, if possible, and then have three bins. Okay, so you have a bin that is absolutely, I will keep this. I will run into a burning building to save this figure. There's no way I'm parting with it. Then you have your things I'm going to sell. And you may even want to sort of separate that out into two categories. One is bin toys, things you would sell for a dollar at a flea market, things that aren't necessarily worth any money and do not necessitate any additional burning of calories from you in order to sell and find them a happy home. And then a subcategory of very, very expensive stuff that is worth the time and effort to put on a site like eBay to kind of get your money back or, you know, be infused with cash to buy more toys from toypizza.com, hopefully. And then the third bin is refuge, right? So part of this is things I'm going to donate, things I'm going to give away with purchase on the store, and things I'm going to send to friends I know like this or like this character or might appreciate having something like that. Don't underestimate the power of sort of giving away toys, because that can be a very fulfilling thing too. My good friend Maddie, he's from Australia, he kind of liked toys and things like that, but got into it in a big way as we became friends and started hanging out. And he's a big collector of McFarlane and NECA scale figures. So he's inherited a ton from me just because it's collecting dust here. Maybe it's worth some money, but I know it's going to make my friend Maddie happy. So I just gladly give it over to him. And it's like Christmas every time we hang out. So, you know, don't underestimate that either. One final note, you know, something I'm trying to do but not doing very well is pick a scale and stick to it. I am a 3¾-inch, 4-inch action figure collector. I try not to veer out of that lane. Even though there's some really fantastic 6-inch figures, you know, I just saw the Marvel Legends Hawkeye with the little sled he rides. I forget the name of it. It's a great figure. I love that era of West Coast Avengers. It's 6-inch scale. I'm not going to appreciate it in a meaningful way. So even though it's on sale on Amazon, it's not my scale. I'm not going to buy it. Next question from Gordon McKinnon Hall. How are you liking your PS5? Are you excited for any upcoming games you weren't considering before? I think it's fine. I don't think it's a dramatic graphical upgrade from PS4. I might feel differently if I go back and play PS4. I think then it would be pretty apparent. But I would have gladly, happily played Dragon's Dogma 2 on PS4 in a sort of minimized graphic capacity. I would have been perfectly content and fulfilled with that. But I have it now, so it does sort of unlock additional side quests for me. The two things that I'm most looking forward to are Dune Awakening, which is a massive online role-playing game set in the Dune universe. Hopefully me and my friends are going to play that, so that should be a lot of fun. And then also Demon's Souls, which I've never played. It's the one game out of the sort of Soulsborne world that I have not experienced. So I'm very much looking forward to diving into that. Depending on when Dune Awakening comes out, I will either, you know, I'll sort of decide which game will be next after Dragon's Dogma 2, which I'm very much enjoying. It is kind of a broken, antiquated game, but I'm having quite a hoot playing it. Next up, we got a good question from our friend Valverde. I'm going to do my best to parse this down from two paragraphs into kind of a succinct question here. His first part is basically, if the collectibles and action figure market is shrinking, how important is it to break new ground as opposed to accepting the market for what it is and exercising nostalgia essentially to cater to a clientele who is seeking that out? The second part of his question here is, it's really about, is Knights of the Slice an homage line or is it not? And is there a portion of customers that will still be drawn to Knights of the Slice believing that its influences or its homages are primarily what this line is about? So for the first part, you know, the collectibles market is shrinking. There's no question. But this is a fashion industry, and it is a trend-based industry. So there are trends. You know, I've been selling Knights of the Slice for 9 years. It's been 10 years in the making at this point. And there have been ebbs and flows throughout that 9 years. I also am lucky enough to converse with a brain trust of people that have been selling toys for even longer than I have, right? So I get information from other sellers that kind of help me fill in overall how everything looks, and more importantly, how everything looks in a timeline of decades, not just in the timeline of 2024. So while we are definitely coming out of a pretty bad valley, but it is still, you know, an extremely rocky terrain in terms of being an independent creator and selling action figures to a market that's really having a crisis at this point, I don't foreclude the possibility that we will have an upswing as well, because I've gone through this cycle before and already. And, you know, people's interest wane, and then people's interest comes back. But I do think the fundamentals of how I make toys and when I release toys and the sort of idea of endlessly expanding the AFOTM those things have changed and are not changing back, right? I have a hard time seeing myself ever trying to ramp up the AFOTM and Patreon enrollment in the same way I did in previous years. I just don't think that that's a possibility. I think that there's a ceiling to the customer base. I think that Patreon is starting to show its age as a platform. And, you know, there are very serious sort of things that the platform does not provide and directions the company is going in that will probably take it off the table at some point in the future, maybe in another 5 years, maybe another 10 years, maybe in a couple months. I don't know. I think also the fundamental of really trying to focus on those Patreon members and the AFOTM members that are the diehards. You know, that has been a very smart shift in how I do my business. It has paid dividends. You know, I can very easily add up what everybody purchases in the Patreon only store versus the public store. And it's pretty staggering what an insanely high percentage rate those really dedicated fans are versus a casual customer that might buy once or twice a year. So while we may be in a depression now, I do think there will be, you know, upticks in the future. And, you know, it's kind of about weathering the storm in many regards. To the point of, like, does my customer only have nostalgia on their brain? Do they only see Nice to Slice as an homage wave? Is that something I care about or should be catering to? Not really. I mean, maybe I should care about it. Maybe I should be catering to it, but I'm not going to do that. Because at the end of the day, this is a creative pursuit for me. I could be making a lot more money, you know, doing entertainment licensing. And I would be in a much better financial situation, but I'd also probably be much more miserable. So it doesn't make sense for me to try to perceive or anticipate what an imaginary audience may or may not be into, or to like cater any aspect of my creative output to, you know, what I think people want. I think that's, for me, been a pretty disastrous recipe. The figures that I've designed thinking, oh yeah, people are going to lose their shit over this, inevitably fall pretty flat. So, you know, people can take away whatever they want from this line. If they believe it is only an homage line, you know, that's their choice. I can't do much about it. The same sort of, you know, theory applies to when I do homages and when I don't. Again, this is my toy line. I've put a lot of time and effort and money into it. And if I want to indulge myself in a nostalgic feeling, I get to do that. You know, that's the beauty part of running the show. So, you know, I guess I don't really pay too much mind or think too much about this angle. This is, first and foremost, a sort of creative output for me. And with any creative thing I do, I want total control over it. And I want to be able to tell a narrative that's not tainted by an over-reliance on nostalgia. And so whatever that formula ends up making in terms of a product that is received or not well received, that's sort of out of my hands. I just have to kind of stick to my gut feeling and my instincts on this. Hi, okay, so much to my chagrin, I opened up my Spotify podcasting app this morning and saw that everything I recorded yesterday is now gone. Part of this, I believe, is because Spotify are trying to push people off of the old Anchor app, which is a company they purchased, to get them to use their new Riverside app. And so they're starting to pull support for the back end of the podcasting app that I've used for all these years I've been doing Distazipod. There was probably about 45 minutes to 50 minutes of audio I recorded. It is now gone. Doesn't exist. And I gotta be honest, I'm too fucking tired to go through the questions again and answer everything. So Do me a favor, if you felt like your question was worthwhile and it is not in the preceding episode, just ask it again in the next Q&A thread, and I will do my best to cover it in the following week. We are seeing in real time the enshittening of not only Spotify, but also their sort of podcasting portion of the services they offer. And it's frustrating, you know? It's tougher and tougher to sort of do these things and to deliver them. What will probably happen is, at a certain point, I'm just going to have to record audio separately just into my Mac for these podcasts because, you know, it's sort of more and more inconvenient to do this. So there may be a juncture in the future where DeSazapod is back behind the Patreon paywall and only hosted locally there, because stuff like this is pretty frustrating. So there you have it. It was supposed to be a jumbo size episode. It is now a mini size episode, but, them's the breaks in this modern era. So, I'll leave it there and we'll speak soon. Pizza out.